Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the sounds of the top stories this week on NHPR.
Once symptoms appear, however, the average time to death is about 4 months. There is no treatment, there is no cure, and there is no screening test.
I had a fair idea of what was going on, but I just got some details that I didn't know.
Like and, what?
Well, those lines are going to come much closer to our property. By the time they cut the trees, I'm going to have a view of power lines that I haven't had in the past.
Louis is a detective in Manchester's burglary unit. And to say he's had a busy summer would be an understatement. During a two-week period in July, the department was seeing 30 burglaries a week.
Spinella seems to be working pretty effectively, but the other vaccine that we're using is a fish meal-based attractant, and that one also works very well.
People want us to get down there and fix Washington, D.C. It's dysfunctional. There's no leadership, and you know, I've spent 34 years in the Marine Corps being taught to be a leader, trained as a leader. I want to bring that leadership down to Washington, D.C.
That was Dr. Joseph Pepe, the head of Catholic Medical Center, where a patient may have been infected with a fatal brain disease. Also, Concord resident Aubrey Davis at a community meeting on Northern Pass. NHPR's Michael Brindley covering a disturbing rise in burglaries in Manchester. The USDA's Jordana Kirby on a program to vaccinate North Country wildlife against rabies. And newly announced 2nd District Congressional candidate Gary Lambert. Another story that made waves in the healthcare community in New Hampshire this week had to do with the approaching rollout of the Affordable Care Act. On October 1st, the so-called health exchanges get up and running. These are online marketplaces where consumers are supposedly going to shop around for insurance. But in New Hampshire, it'll just be one-stop shopping because only one insurer will participate in the first year. And that company, Anthem Blue Cross, announced this week that 10 of the state's hospitals will not be included in its health exchange product, including large hospitals in Concord, Nashua, Portsmouth, and Peterborough. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. We'll cover these stories and much more. Let's hear from you this hour. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests for the roundup this week are Norma Love, Statehouse reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, a welcome back to you too.
Well, thank you.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you, and thank you also for your time.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Well, let's talk first about the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. October is a big month for the ACA, or Obamacare, as some people call it. And to you first, I think, Dean Spiliotis, just remind us what's supposed to happen next month, and then we'll talk about some of these issues that have come up specifically here in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. A couple different things going on. The first thing is we've had this commission essentially studying whether or not to accept additional funds from the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. You may recall that the Supreme Court had a decision that said that states have to be able to choose whether or not they want to accept Medicaid expansion. We're in the process of studying that right now at the state level. There's going to be a report issued in mid-October, and then the governor has the option of calling a special session back in to actually vote on this. You know, politically, the sense has been that Republicans want to drag this out as much as possible, push it into next session if at all possible. So that's the backdrop. The other big thing is the health exchanges. Set up for people who are uninsured to buy insurance in the marketplace. That kicks off October 1st, and we'll talk about this issue of the Anthem Network. Right now, there's currently only one insurer that's going to be in the exchange. Harvard Community Health is going to jump in 2015. So that's kind of the big things for us in the state right now are this Medicaid expansion debate and the beginning of the health exchanges on October 1st.
Well, let's talk just a little bit more about the exchanges. And sure. Norma Love, to you, as Dean said, only one insurer is going to participate the first year, Anthem, and then Harvard Pilgrim will jump in the next year. Anthem announced, as I said, just a day or two ago that 10 hospitals will not be included in their exchange insurance products. 10 out of 26, that's a lot of hospitals, Norma.
I think there's some question, particularly there's some politicians in the state are wondering why, because the Anthem said that the reason they did this was it would keep the premiums lower, the costs lower. But there are certainly some senators whose hospitals in their districts are not included who are wondering why. We were talking about it amongst ourselves in the press room, and some of the thoughts we had were that the first year that we have the exchange, nobody knows who's going to sign up. Nobody knows how sick they're going to be. Nobody knows how many people they're going to be. So Harvard is waiting, I think, to see what there's going to be in the first year. Anthem has already said that it's going to have some limits to keep that population that it doesn't know what it's going to have affordable. Well, they're a profit-making organization. I'm sure they aren't doing this out of the goodness of their heart. So I just don't understand personally, though, what the difference would be if they contracted with the other 10 hospitals. It may be that some of the other 10 hospitals didn't want to take the rates that Anthem offered.
Well, it's become political, Gary, hasn't it, with some saying, look, care is already being rationed and the Affordable Care Act isn't even fully in place yet.
Well, it certainly has become political, but to bring up the point that Norma just made, I was talking to one of the people down at Wentworth Douglas, which is in the network that they have.
Which is.
Is. And they were telling me that basically Anthem said, this is the rate, take it or leave it. So I'm sure that there are some hospitals, particularly like the for-profit hospital, Parkland Medical Center in Derry and Portsmouth Regional, who just said, we're not going to do it. And I wouldn't be surprised if Concord said much the same thing. I think there's a different issue, though, when we get to some of the smaller hospitals, particularly in the North Country and down in particularly Cheshire County.
Yeah, and some concerns that people in the North Country especially will have to travel long distances. I noted, though, Gary, that Concord Hospital is not included. That's a huge hospital serving not just people in Concord, which is a pretty big city by New Hampshire standards, but the wide community around. So that's a gap.
I think it's a gap.
There's one thing that I think I find interesting about this whole discussion is that we're talking about Medicaid expansion, and now we're talking about people going through private exchanges, and some of the Republicans want people to go through the private exchanges. But Medicaid probably is going to give you better access to health care because there are some requirements under Medicaid, I believe, that you have to have certain distance and accessibility to. Look at all the problems they had trying to get the managed care network for Medicaid up and running. They had to get the mental health clinics. They had to get the hospitals. They had to have a network of doctors so that people didn't have to travel. They had access nearby. And yet we're going to have this exchange where that may not be the case.
So, Norma, let me see if I've got this crystal clear. So, in a way, are you better off health care-wise anyway to be of low income? Because Medicaid, you're saying at this point, has a better network, a better system than these exchanges, which are sort of for middle-income people who have a hard time affording insurance. Is that what you're saying?
It's very unclear because one of the problems with this whole process is even though the rules are set by the agencies, that the laws are passed by lawmakers, they're all saying, well, it's confidential. We can't tell you what this network is yet.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. Norma's point is very interesting. The argument is that, you know, the Medicaid expansion, there has been some discussion about doing it through the private insurance, as some other states are doing. That would be limiting in terms of the size of the network. And then on Gary's point, the Concord Hospital, it was a rate issue that they just said the rate was too low and Anthem didn't come back with another offer.
Let's take some calls if we could. Invite our listeners to join us on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We've got a lot to cover today, including the story we're talking about right now, some news concerning the rollout of the exchanges, part of the Affordable Care Act. We're covering that story and much more. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go to Manchester, where Sandra's on the line. Hi, Sandra. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Regarding us having only one option in our exchange in New Hampshire, I seem to recall hearing in the news of late that Representative Carol Shea Porter was going to petition, I think it's Health and Human Services, whatever department's handling the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, to see if New Hampshire could get permission to become part of a regional exchange, a multi-state exchange, and that would give us more options to shop from in the exchange. Do your panelists know anything about that? How is that going?
Well, it's a great question, yeah, and especially relevant here in New England where, you know, we're so close to Massachusetts and all the health facilities there. Go ahead, Norma.
I mean, I've heard it discussed, but I have not heard anybody say, yes, this is what we're going to do. I think the problem is nobody knows what's going to happen on October 1st. Nobody knows what's going to happen on January 1st when this is rolled out. And the normal thing for anyone to do, business or person, is to kind of hold back and let someone else go first.
Yeah, Gary.
Another option is the federal government or Center for Medicaid Services can add other providers to the New Hampshire Exchange in the future. They don't need to go through the same process that they went through this time, where you have to apply, essentially go through the local or the state insurance department and then make a recommendation. They can add others at some point. It doesn't have to be a year from now. It can be 2 months from now.
I see. All right. Well, it's a great question, Sandra. And we will be doing, of course, more coverage here in the Exchange as this deadline of October 1st approaches. One more healthcare question or Affordable Care Act question for all of you. Dean Spiliotis, the Medicaid expansion decision that you touched on earlier, there's been a special commission meeting all summer looking at whether New Hampshire should expand Medicaid to more low-income adults or not. And as you've said so many times, roughly half the states are going this route. Roughly half the states are not. The commission heard from Arizona lawmakers this week. How come Arizona?
Well, they heard from because Arizona has had experience expanding Medicaid back to 2000. So they heard from two Republican lawmakers, state lawmakers from Arizona. When Arizona expanded its Medicaid program in 2000, they had originally planned to have it cost about $2 billion. It ended up costing $8 billion. So at least one of the two Republican state lawmakers from Arizona was saying that this cost us four times what we thought it would cost. We got about 360,000 people into the system, and they little by little fell by the wayside and kind of let their coverage lapse. A lot of people kept using the emergency room anyway for non-emergency services, low-income individuals. So, the one Arizona lawmaker was saying that it was actually very problematic to expand. The other, another Republican state legislator who talked to the commission, made a different argument, and that person said that, we basically ran out of state revenue to cover it, so Obamacare would actually provide money to get the program back up and running properly. So just different perspectives on Medicaid, and Arizona has accepted the expansion. The Republican governor, Jan Brewer, has forced it through.
All right. We have a couple more health-related stories to follow up on, and then there was a lot of news in politics this past week. So all of that is coming up after a short break. Keep it right here.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning, and you're invited to join NHPR in the Music Hall in Portsmouth as we begin a new season of Writers on a New England Stage. NHPR's Virginia Prescott will be speaking with several noted authors, including Margaret Atwood, Bill Bryson, and U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Take a look at the full schedule and get your tickets at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Lutheran Social Services Good News Garage, accepting, repairing, and providing reliable vehicles to families in need. Donate a car, change a life at goodnewsgarage.org. And Mayfair Farm in Harrisville, supporting organic and sustainable farm weekend with gourmet sausage tasting and self-guided tours this Saturday and Sunday. Information at mayfairfarmnh.com. Sunshine today, high temperatures upper 60s to lower 70s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at some of the top headlines of the week. We've been talking about the latest on the Affordable Care Act here in New Hampshire, which we've been talking about that. We'll also look at some of the other stories in the news, including some new candidates possibly putting their hats in the ring for statewide office in 2014. Among them, a familiar name, Charlie Bass. We want your phone calls, your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. One or two more health-related stories, folks, to follow up on. And then I did want to move into some of the news on politics. A rare brain disease was talked about in the news in New Hampshire this week. Yet another hospital, this time Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, ran into trouble for possibly infecting a patient with a rare brain disease. Norma, details are still coming out, obviously, but just give us the bare bones of what seems to have happened here.
Well, apparently this patient had been infected with this, but didn't know it. And it doesn't always show itself for, it can be months, years, it could be 50 years. I don't know the procedure they did on this patient, but the kind of It's called a prion, which is the organism that transmits it. The ordinary sterilization of surgical instruments doesn't kill it. I read somewhere that if you were to do what you needed to do to kill that organism, you'd destroy the instruments. Well, they're costly instruments, so they'd sterilize them in the normal way. And they believe they may, and that's the key word here, may have exposed up to 8 other people to this prion. And so the head of the hospital has been reaching out to these people. There's no way of knowing if or when they might contract it. But if the symptoms are basically like a dementia, and the brain, the proteins in the brain create like a sponge effect, and people die within a few months.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said may with that emphasis, though, Norma, because from what I've read, there's very little chance that the other patients have contracted this disease. Officials said close to zero, but not zero. So obviously you want to, you know, you want to keep an eye on it. And if it were me, I would be very nervous as well. But they have said it's pretty minimal that other folks got this. Here's the broader question, though, for you, Dean. What does this story do for public confidence in our hospitals, given that we also had the Exeter Hospital hepatitis C crisis, where more than 30 people were infected from a drug-addicted hospital worker? So it's sort of the bigger theme here.
Right. And it's interesting. There are a couple issues at play here. The first is it is very unlikely that it's transmitted. It's something like 1 in 1,000,000 chance of actually getting it. I was fascinated to learn, and I'm sure some people will be quite upset to know, that when you sterilize instruments, not everything gets killed. I have no idea that that's how it works. Also, some of this equipment was rented from a firm in Minneapolis, so it may have been used in other hospitals as well. So that kind of expands the scope a little bit. And the final interesting thing is it has the same name. It's Creutzfeldt-Jakob or Jakob's disease as mad cow. So when I first heard the story, I was like, mad cow disease has come to New Hampshire, but it's not the same thing. It's a different variant. They're not related. So this is a concern, and you've seen the medical community work in the hospital work really hard to reassure people that this is very unusual. It's very unlikely to be indicative of a larger problem, because something like this can just really destroy public confidence. Yeah, I haven't seen any polling data on it, and I'm sure we will at some point. It's a potential concern.
Yeah. Norma, do you want to jump in there super quick?
I think all of us think that hospitals are perfect. We're all never going to have a single problem. And we have to realize that this society, everything that we do in medicine and everything, we're still growing. And to have the instruments not be sterilized to kill this one prion, it's not surprising to me.
I want to ask you all about another story that also happened in Manchester. Last week, Manchester police announced their biggest drug bust ever, perhaps the biggest ever in the state. Then this week, Gary Reno, they held a community meeting on the rising number of burglaries related to drugs, they said. What are we seeing in Manchester, Gary, and in other cities and towns around the state?
This has been building for some time. The hard drug scene has certainly been moving out of the major cities into up this way into Manchester, Nashua. It's also moving up the Connecticut Valley up that way. And we're starting to see all this sort of come together where the people are needing these drugs in a really big way. I mean, they're very much addicting. They're all very addicting. We know that. And these people have to find a way to pay for them. And so they're breaking into houses, and they're breaking into a lot of houses in Manchester right now.
And the numbers are pretty startling.
Over 300, I believe, something like that.
So, yeah. So what are police saying they're going to do about this, Gary? I mean, there's sort of two tracks, isn't there? One is trying to stop the burglaries,
drugs.
And the other is trying to get people off the drugs.
Right. I think what they're trying to do is basically shut off the supply as much as they can, which obviously this big drug bust will help. And then hopefully that will bring some awareness to what's going on, and people will start locking their doors and be a little more aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
And why people are out there doing these things.
You know, one more drug-related story that kind of made my eyes go wide open, folks, is earlier this week news that a notorious international drug cartel is going to face trial in Concord. These are one of these, you know, drug cartels that literally do operate all over the globe. Seems to be based in Mexico. They were arrested in Spain, though, Dean Spiliotis. Sure. Here's my question. Why are they trying these folks in Concord?
Yeah, I had the same reaction when I saw the headline. This is, as you mentioned, it's not only a local story, but it's a national, international story. Basically, starting in 2009, the FBI undercover agents began meeting with these individuals and talking about literally shipping tons of drugs around the world. The reason why they can use New Hampshire is because several of these undercover meetings took place in New Hampshire, in Newcastle, Portsmouth, maybe a function of the evidence they have from those meetings. It may be just a function of once that it takes place within the state. And this actually, to some extent, began from a link or a tip in Massachusetts. So it does have kind of local roots. So that allows the federal government to use a venue in New Hampshire as a result. But it is interesting to see local prosecutors prepping for kind of an international drug case.
Right. It's huge. It's going to be right downtown Concord and
right.
And
but
so
the FBI undercover meetings in New Hampshire are sort of the connection.
I see. Gary.
When they had the press conference to announce these indictments, I asked the U.S. Attorney, John Krakowicz. I said, well, is there some advantage to having this here? And he said, well, no. I said, well, why are we having it here? He said, because some of these meetings took place here. And I think the other issue, too, is if you think about what's been going on in the Boston federal courthouse, which, you know, they've been tied up with the Whitey Bulger trial for so long. I mean, there's an ample opportunity to have the trial here. There's not quite as heavy a gender as there are some other places.
Okay. Well, and we've been talking about the crime-related toll of drugs and the robberies in Manchester and the international drug cartel being tried in Concord. But, Norma Love, there's a terrible human toll as well. Two college students died of drug overdoses. A New Hampshire, a UNH student this week from a drug called Molly. Earlier, a Plymouth State University student. It just really hits home to see these, you know, just lovely young people. You see their pictures in the paper, and they look so bright and full of life, and they're gone very quickly from these drug overdoses. What are officials at these schools saying about this, and what are we to make of this?
Well, I think it's really kind of I don't know what school officials can say about it, because it's happening on the hip-hop kind of scene, the concert scene where people go, young kids go, and supposedly it heightens the music. It's a form of ecstasy, and there's some thought that perhaps the drugs that these students took was impure in some way. But I saw a doctor talking about the reaction, and you're in a big crowd, you get warm, you don't realize what your body is reacting to, and then there's this huge crash at the end. And so it's the one that involved the the New Hampshire girl. She was down in Boston, and I believe two other people survived who had also had a reaction to the drug that
Molly,
day.
It's
Molly,
called, yeah.
Just to jump in real quick, yeah, and we should point out that these drug deaths did not occur on campus. They were at big dance clubs, and actually the young woman who died from UNH, she was at a 100,000-person DJ dance festival in New York. And a number of people are overdosing in the Northeast. The Plymouth State student died in Boston, I believe, at the House of Blues. And so there's some concern that there's just sort of a particularly bad shipment or version of this Molly, this particular type of ecstasy. So this isn't a function of campus. This is a function of what's going on at these big raves, these big dance parties. And as Norma said, students are not really experienced with this, and it ended up killing some. And there were others who were overdosed but survived.
All right. Well, again, relates to this broader issue that we're talking about, the increase in illegal drug use here in northern New England. The number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. I want to ask all of you about politics, and there's been some big news this week. After Labor Day, things usually pick up, and that's certainly been the case. And Gary Reno, to you first. Charlie Bass, former 2nd District Congressman, is said to be contemplating a run for U.S. Senate. This was reported in your paper, The Union Leader.
Yes, Charlie is saying he's giving it serious consideration. Obviously, when Jeb Bradley took himself out earlier this week, saying he wasn't going to run for the U.S. Senate, which I think a lot of people thought he was, that opened up the field, and Charlie said he's interested. However, I mean, you really have to think that he's probably getting some pressure from people in the Republican Party who really wants somebody with some name recognition at the top of that ticket, or there could be real problems as you go down the list, and it's sort of like you have nobody who's with a real name recognition who's talking about running for governor now, nobody with a lot of name recognition running for the U.S. Senate. So you get to those two people, and then it's sort of like, watch out below if you're a Republican.
Although, reality check, Norma, I mean, it's only early September 2013. The elections aren't until the fall of 2014. So is it really time for Republicans to get so nervous? Don't they have plenty of time to find
some people? No, it really is time for them to get nervous, because you have to start fundraising. If you're going to run it for the U.S. against Jean Shaheen, a money machine for the U.S. Senate, I mean, you have to. She's going to have the backing of a party. With the Senate divided the way it is, every seat counts. And she's got very high poll numbers, very high favorability numbers. She's very well known. She was state senator. She was a governor. So I think that's a race Republicans, I don't know whether they're looking for somebody they can beat Shaheen, or they think that, well, at least give her a run for her money. All right, then you're going to have the governor's race. Who's running for governor? You have to have someone go up against a sitting governor, a freshman governor. New Hampshire's, in recent memories, only turned back one, and that was Craig Benson, and said, no, you can't have a second term. And so far, Republicans that I've talked to don't think that Hassan has done anything really outrageous. What are they going to run on? So it's early for something to develop, an issue to develop, but it's not early to line up the money and kind of crowd out the field.
Well, it's interesting, too, what Gary said, Dean, that former Congressman Bass may have decided to test the waters after he heard that State Senator Jeb Bradley was not going to run for statewide office. Just remind us what happened with former Congressman and current State Senator Bradley.
Yeah, he is someone who had been mentioned as both a possible Republican candidate for U.S. Senate against Jean Shaheen, and even perhaps a Senate Majority Leader, then turning and running against Governor Hassan when she runs for re-election. So those were two possibilities. At one point, he had joked with New York Congressman Peter King when he was up here visiting that the rumors were true that he was going to run. It picked up some national coverage. He backed away from that. He has cited some personal illnesses in his family that requires attention right now, so he can't fully focus on a Senate run. He seems to enjoy being Majority Leader as well, so he's going to continue to do that in the Senate. I think the larger point here is that people who watch politics in the state closely know what the Republican bench looks like, and we've already run through most of those names at this point for people who might potentially run. So I think there is a concern, as Gary said, that if you really do put up kind of a sacrificial slate of Republican candidates in 2014, it could have real repercussions all the way down the line in terms of the state house and other local races. It may be the case that people are kind of picking their battles and waiting for 2016, which could shape up to be a kind of a free-for-all at the presidential level. But for whatever reason, we've been through, a lot of the usual suspects have already taken a pass. We've been through the Sununus. Bradley's not going to run. Chuck Morris is going to be Senate president. Peter Bragdon has started his new job. So all the kinds of names that we've kicked around, they've all sort of taken themselves out of the running already. And I think there is concerns among Republicans that their bench of candidates really isn't where it should be this time around.
Norma.
And I don't think we should think of it as Republicans in sort of a homogenous way, because you
sure
have probably several groups. You have the moderates, the establishment, and now the far libertarian Tea Party candidates. And in a primary, you could really get beat up pretty badly if you've got competition among two members of your own party and you're in different factions.
Well, I want to ask you about some of those other names that have come up this week, but also invite our listeners to join us. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we're talking about some of the top headlines of the week. Join us with your questions and comments. What news items caught your attention, especially this week? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. So we've been talking about the U.S. Senate race. Charlie Bass may jump in. Jeb Bradley says no, he's not going to. Gary Reno, next week, former state senator Jim Rubins will have an announcement, and looks to me like he's going to make it official.
Oh, I think that's hardly a question. I think Jim has been running since he said he was interested about 3 or 4 months ago. And Jim is an interesting guy. I mean, he's kind of cuts across some of the divide in the Republican Party. He's moderate on some issues, very conservative on others. But he's certainly not a big name that people know in the state. He ran for governor, but that was more than 10 years ago. And he was a state senator.
He was very active in the anti-casino movement this year.
And he's also been very active in several other areas, doctors against
Union of Concerned Scientists, I think, anti-climate, working against climate change. Yeah. So another question about former Senator Rubins and someone else. Rubins this week has been raising Senator Shaheen's Syria vote in his emails. And I just want to let everybody know we're going to talk more about Syria on Monday, including looking at how our own delegation here in New Hampshire has responded. But what do you think, Dean Spiliotis? Is Syria going to be a big issue in the congressional races next year? Again, this is a whole year away.
It could be. The last decade is full of examples where, you know, votes on these kinds of foreign policy resolutions have come back to haunt different candidates. We saw it big time in 2004 when a number of Democratic presidential candidates had to back away from their vote in favor of the Iraq war resolution. And actually, Howard Dean really built his candidacy on that, on the backs of the anti-war movement. So, you know, if anti-war progressives in the state get really fired up about this, we're already seeing, as you mentioned, the members of the House, Shea Porter and Custer, either voting against or thinking about voting against. That could have an impact. A lot of it depends on how it goes. If Obama does a strike, we get further and further involved, that could be problematic.
All right. And again, on Monday, we're going to follow up a lot more on that. But since you mentioned Emma McLean Custer, Norma Love, this week, someone jumped in to go up against Congresswoman Custer, Gary Lambert, for the 2nd Congressional District.
Gary Lambert is a former state senator, one-term state senator. He's retiring from the Marine Reserves. I think he's conservative. He's anti-abortion, I think. He's also anti-gay marriage. He's someone who I think will probably, if you look at Custer, who's on the more on the liberal side, you would put him, tip the pendulum all more on the conservative side. And I think he wants to go down to – he thinks Congress is dysfunctional, which is a common complaint by candidates that we're going to go down there and fix it. I think it yet remains to be seen as the campaign unfolds what his ideas are on how he would fix it.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break, and we'll talk about the Northern Pass coming south, making its case in Concord, also taking a look at an anti-rabies program in the North Country. We'll talk about that and a lot more after a short break. You can join us 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR. It's 9:38. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama seeks support for military strikes in Syria. The White House steps up its PR campaign for healthcare enrollment. Then, the G20 summit gets underway in St. Petersburg, Russia. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Hillsborough House, a locally owned nursing facility improving the experience and delivery of rehab and residential care for over 50 years. Information at hillsboroughhouse.org. And from New Hampshire Humanities Council, presenting Colin McCann, author of Let the Great World Spin, at its annual dinner on October 28th at the Center of New Hampshire. Details at nhhc.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, a panel of Granite Staters talks about a possible American strike against the Syrian government. We want to know what you think. Send us email before the program to exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us Monday morning, live at 9 for that. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at the top headlines from around the Granite State this week, and we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, a couple more stories that we do need to take a look at. And Norma Love, I want to turn to you first. The Northern Pass, we've talked a lot about that on this program. We're going to be talking more about it next week on Tuesday. But this past week, Norma, the Northern Pass came to Concord. Why so far south?
Well, it's a 187-mile-long transmission line, and most of the focus has been in the North Country, where really, really angry meetings and opposition to the possibility of having these tall, extra tall towers across the mountaintops or, you know, of New Hampshire, which they many of them have lived there because that's what they want. That's where why they have stayed so far away from the rest of us. But anyway, it goes all the way down to 187 miles. So what Northern Pass is doing is they're having a series of meetings up and down the line to try and win, I think, some kind of public confidence and that they're going to do a good job of meeting their needs. And I think what they're probably going to run into, as they did in Concord, are people saying, wait a minute, I can see that tower from my house. And personally, it's going to go probably a mile from my house, but I don't know whether I'll see it or not. It's just it comes right down through Concord, and then it'll go on south, and they'll continue to have these meetings. They've offered to bury about 8 miles of the line up north, and there are a lot of people, particularly the New Hampshire Forest Society, Protection of New Hampshire Forests, who's saying, hey, if you can bury 8 miles, why don't you bury 187 miles, or why don't you take it down the transportation corridor and not interrupt any of our visible tourist-attracted tree line? It's going to be interesting to see what happens next, because the Department of Energy has to weigh in with an environmental impact statement. And then once they go through the federal process, it has to go through a site evaluation committee, which is a state process. And they can, at that point, run into some opposition from the state. So it has a ways to go. But right now, they're trying to do the public relations thing.
Well, and it's interesting because so far it has been, rightly or wrongly, more of a North Country story. I wonder what you think, Dean Spiliotis. This focus further down the line, as Norma described, how does this kind of change the dynamic around Northern Pass?
Sure. You're getting into more heavily populated areas. There's a potential to, as a result, mobilize more people in opposition to the project. You know, my understanding for Concord is that they're going to use kind of existing rights of way, but these towers are going to be much taller, like 90 to 110 feet, something like that. And I understand why they're doing this public relations blitz and setting it up where, you know, you go and rather than have like a town hall meeting, you go from kind of station to station and talk directly with public relations people and engineers.
It's
and
more
other,
like an open house.
Yes, it's an open house. Right. And it's a little more personal that way, but you also have the opportunity to get on a computer and pull up the route and see how close it is to your house. So, you know, for every person that you may sort of assuage, there's a danger that you're going to create a new opponent when someone gets on and realizes, hey, you know, that's going to come pretty close to my house.
But there are also people who are going to say,
sure,
why should I care?
Exactly.
I
the other risk is, right, it's like,
house.
Okay, I'm, you know, I, so for me, for example, I'm at least several miles away from where this is going to be. Someone like that may say, well, okay, I don't have to worry about it. Good, I'll go on to other things.
But, Gary, go ahead.
And there are other, I mean, there's a, like, Franklin is a big beneficiary from this whole project because there'd be a station there that would transfer or convert it from direct current to alternating current. And their property tax bills will be going down in Franklin if this ever gets built because it would add so much to their tax base. And so, I mean, you get all kinds of reactions. So you have an open house in Franklin, you're going to have all kinds of people who think it's a great idea. I mean, but technically you have this issue with the distance you need between the lines if you have alternating current and direct current, and that makes a big difference as to how tall these are. And
I see.
That's why you're seeing a lot larger towers than you see now in these existing right-of-ways.
And I think the biggest thing, just quickly, is that this is not something that New Hampshire ratepayers will be supporting. It's an investment. It's a privately paid project, and the electricity is going to southern New Hampshire.
We will talk a lot more about this story on Tuesday, promise. So join us then if you want to hear more on it. Right now, we're taking your questions and comments about some of the top headlines of the week, including the Northern Pass meetings in Concord and elsewhere, more southerly in New Hampshire. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Now, Dean Spiliotis, across the state, there was good news. Home prices, home sales, keep rising steadily. People are pretty happy about that.
That's right. And I recall talking about a similar story last month, because this is the 20th straight month in which home sales have been up. Prices are up as well, about almost 11% over the same time last year, which is also that is also good news. The median sales price for a home is now up to $230,000. It was about $208,000 same time last year. That's a nice increase. It's still not as high as it was at the peak of the market in 2005. But this is all good news, because you have to keep in mind that, at the beginning of the recession, we were dealing with the subprime mortgage crisis, the collapse of the housing market. So I think there's general agreement now that we are in a housing recovery. And the question is sort of how quickly will we rebound to where we were in 04 and 05.
Yeah, it's not so nice if you're out shopping for a house.
Absolutely, though. It is people, as I've had several, there's a lot of stuff for sale in my neighborhood and a lot of sale pending signs going up very quickly, which is good news after some of these homes had been on the market for several years. I had one realtor tell me the difference is this time around houses are priced to sell. So people are asking for a little bit less and selling more quickly.
Yeah, interesting. I had a friend who put hers on the market, and boy, seemed like a week before she had an offer. And I think it was even cash. I mean, here you go.
Well, I remember in the 80s when we had the housing boom bust, and I had someone describe it to me, a realtor. He said, Norma, it's kind of like a python that swallowed a little dog. there's an unrealistic assumption or expectation of what things are worth. And if you buy in when at the height of the little dog, you're in trouble. But if you bought in before, you're okay.
And I think one of the big things that really is helping the market right now is the reduction in the foreclosure homes that are they said that's been the lowest it's been in ages.
And finally getting all those foreclosed homes
through.
Off
that's
the going
to help the prices go up when those houses get out of the market.
All right, this is a little bit of an awkward segue from pythons and dogs, Norma, but I'm going to try it. So bear with me here. In the North Country, there was a real interesting story this week about the U.S. Department of Agriculture dropping vanilla-flavored rabies vaccine in the forests of northern New Hampshire, Dean. I have to tell you, we've got a lot of response on this story. Why is USDA doing this?
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating, too. Basically, the idea is to prevent rabies from spreading up into Canada, essentially by vaccinating wild critters who, find these vanilla packets. And I believe some other packets are or have been also made with some sort of fish meal. So they're trying different types of mixes in order to see what appeals to these animals. So you essentially create like a swath or a corridor that is rabies-free right at the Canadian border. I think what I've read is that there's something like 23 or 25 cases of rabies, not individuals, but found in animals so far.
In animals, not people.
Yeah, not people. No. So they, in the animal population, they've verified something like roughly two dozen cases of rabies. Whether that's unusual or not, I don't know the backstory on that. But it really is kind of it's part of a five-state pilot program. To see if they can create this sort of rabies-free zone heading up on into Canada. I was interested, I have a dog, and I was wondering, what if I find one in the woods? Apparently, you can move these things. If you find them, if you're concerned about either pets, they're not harmful to pets. If you're concerned about a child or a pet, you can actually move these to other areas.
You
in the
can
woods.
Pick them up.
Yeah, they're literally just, it's not, they're not spraying or powdering. They're literally dropping packets that the animals then tear into. And apparently, vanilla worked really well as an attractant.
I thought they'd make garbage flavored ones for the raccoons. But, and we got four comments on Facebook even before the program started on this. Kythe said, is it a blanket attempt or do they have specific zones where the numbers of rabies infected animals are on the rise? Sounds like you answered that, Dean, that it's this swath at the Canadian border.
It's COAS and Northern Grafton is where they're doing the pilot. Whether the sort of rabies population is higher naturally up there, and again, most of the rabies that they found has been in, I believe, skunks, raccoons, and foxes.
Yeah, and then Timothy asks, is it effective for humans? Doesn't sound like it's intended for humans. And then someone named Porcupine says, this sounds stupid. How many doses might animals come upon and ingest? That's actually something I hadn't thought about. I mean, if they like the vanilla so much and they find two or three, maybe they eat two or three, and that might not be good for them.
There is no rabies vaccine for humans, which is why if you get bitten, you have to go through that series of shots.
I see.
It's not like your dog or your cat, or I don't know about cats, but dogs, you get a vaccine and they're protected. Not the case for humans.
Cats get them, too.
Cats get them, too.
But, one of the thoughts I question was, didn't we have like a rabies explosion a number of years back and the raccoons died? We ended up with a decimation of the rabies, the raccoon population.
All right. Well, thanks for all those Facebook comments. Clearly lots of interest in this story. And Sam Evans Brown, our environment reporter, did a piece on it earlier this week. So you could go to nhpr.org and look up Sam's story if you want to know more. In the last few minutes we have left, folks, I want to return to the State House because it's my understanding that things will get a little bit busier there this fall now that everybody's back from their vacations. And Gary Reno, Chuck Morse is now officially the Senate president after Peter Bragdon stepped down to take a new job at the local government center. What's your sense, Gary, of how active a role Senate President Morse will play in promoting some of the hot issues like expanded gambling, like how the state will respond to Northern Pass, like Medicaid expansion? Is he going to take a pretty active role? What do you think?
Well, traditionally, the Senate president doesn't take such an active role. In those. They usually have a small agenda, but where you have Chuck Morse, who's been such an advocate for gambling all these years, I mean, I can't see that he's going to back off that much at all. Some of these other issues, too, I mean, we could see yesterday when he came out with a statement on this issue with the Anthem and the small network. I mean, he went right after the Governor Haas and people, and I don't think you could see that. I don't think you would see that from Peter Bragdon.
A little bit more pulled back and let the senators
back.
Decide
so
how they feel.
He wants to be very active right out of the box.
Okay, that'll make things interesting this fall and next year. Norma.
Well, Senator Bragdon had made, I don't know if we would call them promises, but certainly he had talked to some of the senators. When you have a 13-11 split, every senator's vote counts. And when we came to the budget, you had some debate over expanding Medicaid. And there are a couple of Republicans who really are thinking more along the lines of expanding Medicaid, and there are other Republicans who are pretty much no, 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 no. Well, when you have one vote either way, how do you pass a budget? So Senator Bragdon, I think, who was in the forefront of this commission, had told some
the Medicaid expansion.
Had, I think, led Senator Nancy Stiles to believe that at least that there would be an opening to debate, discuss an alternative. That remains how that plays out now that there's a change at the top. Well, I don't know. I talked to Senator Morse, and he said he just has to see. At this point, he doesn't think it's been determined either what the commission will come out with or what the Republican position will be. The second thing is that we talked about gambling. Well, within that, Senator Jim Marouch of Derry was very, very adamant that when they what they called indefinitely postponed the gas tax bill from the House in response to the House killing the casino bill, that they had to do something for infrastructure. And if they didn't do something next year, they shouldn't even file for reelection. And Senator Marouch has been working on a gas tax bill. Senator Bragdon said whether they allowed it in under the rules when you indefinitely postpone something, you say we can't discuss this again the rest of this session, the two-year session. Well, he said, well, I'll decide if it's similar. Well, he's not in the chair anymore. Senator Morse will decide whether it's similar, and he's very much opposed to a gas tax.
And very much in favor of casino gambling.
Correct. So it's unclear what's going to happen there.
Wow, yeah, and you're reminding of this whole tit-for-tat that we saw earlier this year, right, Norma? The House wanted a gas tax to pay for infrastructure projects. The Senate wanted casino gambling. Each said no to the other's idea, and we were kind of just left.
And what will happen is the Interstate 93 expansion project has enough money to keep things going until about the fall of 2015. Well, you have to start ahead of that to keep contractors on board.
Right.
And if they don't do something if they wait until the next round of legislators and they start doing it in the budget and then it's July of 2015, there may not be enough time to keep those contractors on board.
Well, again, if people want more detail on that, we talked with the Transportation Commissioner, Chris Clement, about 2 weeks ago. So a lot more on that on the exchange program with Transportation Commissioner Clement a week or two back. Here's an email that came in from Kelly, who says, I'm not sure how many of your guests have students on campus at UNH or PSC. I went out to visit my child Tuesday and take her to dinner to touch base. My understanding is that Molly, this is the drug that we talked about, is prevalent on campus and is used fairly casually. I would have been left with the impression from your guests that it isn't a campus issue, rather an event issue. Kelly says that's not accurate. Kids died at these large events, maybe due to the overheating issue or maybe due to bad drugs, but parents need to reach out to their kids on campus and educate them about the risks. And Kelly, thank you so much. And I definitely had some conversations in my household with my older child about, look, don't go near this stuff. But thank you so much, Kelly, for the email. I wanted to wrap up with the three of you just talking about what you're going to be looking at in terms of the news next week. And boy, there's a lot to consider. Dean Spiliotis, what's going to be on the front of your radar?
Well, now I'm going to keep an eye on Charlie Bass. But the Syria vote, we now have Jeanne Shaheen, the first senator on record in our delegation voting in favor of the resolution.
Senate Foreign Relations Committee,
she voted in favor. It was a close vote, 10-7. Kelly Ayotte said she supports it. Members of our House delegation are leaning the other way at this point, so I'll be watching that. And I just want to say that was I appreciate that email, because while the deaths were at events, it is good to know, to get a sense of what's going on campus.
Yeah, Kelly, thanks a lot. And Gary, how about you?
We have the continuing Medicaid expansion commission that's going to be meeting. Also, the Gambling Commission next week. And,
right, I forgot about that. Yeah,
and we have another one starting up on the genetically engineered.
Genetically modified foods, right.
Are coming up.
Yes, and NHPR did some coverage of that, so we'll probably follow up on that next week. Yeah. Thanks, Gary. And Norma, how about you?
Well, I think the gambling one is probably going to be more interesting this week because it's a hearing, so people will be able to come out and talk about what regulations they think would be needed to effectively control a casino.
All right. Lots to keep an eye on. Thank you all very much for being here. Gary, thank you. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
That's Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader. Norma Love, thanks a lot. Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. And Dean Spiliotis, thank you also for your time.
Sure thing.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, a panel of Granite Staters reflects on the possibility of military action against the Syrian government. Then we return to the Northern Pass debate as supporters think of new ways to reach out while the opposition remains solid. Later, the problem of teenage drinking. Also, we talk with the new Commissioner of Resources and Economic Development, Jeffrey Rose. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Ian Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next to 10 here on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, now in the heart of Concord, offering an MBA. Information at nec.edu. And the Woodstock, Vermont Area Chamber of Commerce hosting the 4th Annual Art Festival and Wine Tasting this Saturday and Sunday on the Green. Information at woodstockvt.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. President Obama says he is confident Congress will agree to a military strike against Syria, despite divisions on Capitol Hill. But a top aide says on NPR this morning that it's unlikely the president will act without congressional approval. The New York Times and others